said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Professor Jeffrey Sachs, a university professor of Columbia University and the director of their Center on Sustainable Development. And he's also the United Nations Sustainable Development Solution Network chairman. He's got a forthcoming book out. No, it just came out, actually. I haven't had one in my hands yet, but it's The Ages of Globalization by Columbia University Press, and I hope we can explore that a little bit too. I must also note that Jeffrey and I are fellow Detroiters, and my mother's best friend, Aphrodite Rommel, was married to a man named George Rommel, who was a very close friend and professional associate of Jeff's father. What that meant is that as an undergraduate at MIT, Lisa Rommel, who was my sister's best friend, was encouraged me over and over and over to follow the developing career of Jeffrey Sachs, which I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I took that advice. At any rate, Jeff, thanks for being here today.
Hey, Rob, great to be with you, and great to revisit our Detroit roots together.
That's right. That's right. It's the most recent thing that I've seen is that a statement was issued by the Lancet Commission on COVID-19, which you're the chairman of, the statement on the global pandemic. Why don't we start there and share with the audience what your thoughts were in that process and what the statement brings to the surface.
Thanks a lot. I'm sure everybody agrees that the unprecedented and dangerous times that we're living in really require all of us to find ways to contribute to solving this pandemic and getting through it intact globally. We've got 30 million confirmed cases. We have nearly a million deaths worldwide, 200,000 in the United States. It's horrific. And it has also overturned economies all over the world, including our own, of course, in the United States. The Lancet, the British medical and public health journal, kindly asked me to help assemble experts from across a range of disciplines, public health, virology, ecology, finance, humanitarian response, to try to get a holistic vision of this unprecedented crisis that we're living through right now. And I'm really thrilled to be chairing a commission with a group of world leaders across many different fields that have a important role to play in containing and suppressing this pandemic. So the UN General Assembly 75th session, since the UN started in 1945, we're at this historic anniversary, opened just now on September 15, and on that occasion, the Commission issued its first statement. The statement is a set of initial findings and recommendations of how to respond to the pandemic, especially how to use effective public health to stop the transmission of the virus, because many countries have done that, not the United States, certainly, not the countries in the Western Hemisphere, tragically so, but countries notably in the Asia Pacific. And while we're using those so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions or NPIs, like face mask wearing, to stop the transmission, how to accelerate the development and then the fair deployment of an effective vaccine. In addition, the Commission noted what I think we all sense, but we don't probably sense adequately, there is a fast rising humanitarian crisis of an extreme nature developing in many parts of the world to the point of hunger, destitution, and desperation below the surface in many countries, but extraordinarily serious. And we have to be on top of that in real time, not 6 months later, not a year later when we see the consequences of that disaster, but in real time. So we took note of that. We pointed out that the origins of this pandemic, most likely, according to the best scientific evidence, is that this is a naturally occurring zoonotic event, meaning that this is a virus that was in horseshoe bat populations in southwest China, and probably COVID-19 as a pandemic emerged from a natural event where the virus passed from the bat reservoir to human reservoirs. There is, as people know, a counterclaim. It is not in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. It is in the airwaves, though, that this was a lab-manipulated and lab-released virus in China. And so we note that the evidence to date is that this is a natural occurring event, but this is something that we are absolutely going to research during the course of the commission, which will issue its final report in early 2022. So I was happy to make this statement. I think that if countries could learn from the successes of those places that have suppressed the pandemic, we'll save a lot of lives. And that's the main message of the statement at this point, Rob.
And could you just briefly describe what are those places and what did they do that was so impressive?
I think the logic of the situation is relatively straightforward, which is the following, that when someone is infected by the virus, typically after about 6 or 7 days, they become infectious to others. And maybe a day or two or three after they become infectious, they become symptomatic in most cases. So they have clinical symptoms of some kind, though this pretty devilish virus. Some people never develop symptoms. Some people have very mild cases. And then the range of symptoms is quite large. But the logic is, person's infected. They have a few days of incubation until the symptom period. They become infectious probably before the symptoms appear for 24, 48 hours, in fact. They are infectious for perhaps another week to 10 days. And then either the individual heads to a hospital and death in some small proportion of cases, or to recovery and no longer shedding the virus, typically to the point of being infectious to others. Okay, what's the point of all of that? The point of all of that is, if we somehow could wave the magic wand and note that around the world there are many, many people infected right now. We know many of them, but we don't know all of them because many have not been tested. But there are about 7 million people in active cases confirmed by testing, and perhaps even 10 times more than that unconfirmed without tests yet. If somehow those people would not infect others, so if somehow those people, for example, were in safe isolation or quarantine for the next 2 weeks, this would end worldwide because there would be no further infections. And the statistic that is key that many people have come across in recent months is the reproduction rate, which measures how many people an average infectious person today will infect during the course of the infection. And if on average that's less than one other person, And if ideally it was zero other people, then the epidemic stops. Now, the epidemic isn't stopping because people who are infectious are still infecting other people. They're not being tested, they're not quarantining, and so on. The logic of suppressing the epidemic then is to have in place enough barriers to transmission that that reproduction number is below one and stays below one. Now, how do you do that? Well, one basic way is that people wear face masks. And this is not a left-right political issue. This is a basic issue. Don't infect other people. And if you don't know whether you're infectious or not, wear a face mask anyway. We all should. That would drop the rate of infection. A second obvious way is physical distancing. It's not impossible for the virus to transmit when people are across a whole room, but it's much more likely if they're close together and talking with each other. A third way is to stop big public events, which technically are called super spreader events. Rock concerts, religious meetings, large parties, weddings, and so forth, because we know, or the Sturgis motorcycle rally. This is a disaster when hundreds or even thousands or tens of thousands of people are brought together. Of course there's going to be major spread. If our nincompoop president would stop having these rallies, which are so reckless, this would make an important contribution as well. So having safe workplaces, monitoring for symptoms, having adequate testing so that people can find out their status. For each confirmed case, there should be dozens of tests because each confirmed case has contacts with dozens of other people. And that means also using contact tracing to know when someone has been confirmed positive, who have they been close to? Family members, fellow people in households. If it's congregate setting like a nursing home, my God, don't let it spread throughout the nursing home. If it's colleagues at work and so forth, these contacts need to be traced. Now, the countries, especially in the Asia Pacific, China, as the most notable huge country, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, Australia, New Zealand, Cambodia, Laos, or Lao PDR, they've all basically suppressed the transmission of the virus by combining all those methods that I've said. In the United States, we're at the other end of the spectrum. The president, you know, has rallied against wearing face masks. He wants everything open. He's, of course, lied to us repeatedly and acknowledged lying to us as if cheerleading, oh God, is somehow the right approach in this rather than public health control. So the United States has ended up with so much more infection per person, so many more deaths per person than in the Asia Pacific. And where you've had this kind of terrible response, and other cases in our region include Brazil with Bolsonaro and Mexico with AMLO, two populist leaders in the Trump mold, you end up with mass deaths, you end up with mass transmission, and you end up with the economies that are sunk by this in the name, ironically, of keeping the economy open. It does no such thing when there's a rip-roaring pandemic. So the point of the statement is maybe what's the hardest thing in America these days. Look at other countries and learn from them. And this is a message to every country in the world. There is a group of countries that has suppressed the pandemic. Look at what they did, study what they did, learn from it. And that's the hope of this statement.
Yeah, I'd heard some people say that the American idea of freedom is the freedom to do whatever you want. And often my European friends will say things like, you have the freedom to own a gun and shoot me, but I don't have the freedom to walk around without the risk of being shot. Well, at some level, the freedom that people are strident about is the freedom to infect others.
That's and it. That's exactly right. The idea that I don't have to wear a face mask is a absolutely irresponsible point of view. And freedom is not about irresponsibility. Freedom should not be about doing harm to others and having the freedom to do harm to others. Indeed, it's classic liberalism that you can be free as long as you're not harming others. But wearing a face mask is a minimum stake in the well-being of others and preventing you from harming others. It's incredible how this got twisted in the extreme versions of libertarianism or liberty in the U.S. Psyche in, of course, one part of the population.
Yeah, and it's also quite an unmasking of the youth health, the United States healthcare system. Because we've always talked about we're at this vanguard of pharmaceutical development, vanguard of this and vanguard of that. And then you look at World Health Organization and we rank about 38th. You look at the OECD expenses and America pays about twice as much per capita for healthcare as places that perform much better. And that was all before the pandemic. But now seeing what you might call our response to the crisis, and as you underscored moments ago, the number of deaths in the United States, I mean, we're more than 20% of the deaths in the world. We are nowhere near 20% of the population of the world.
And we're about 4%, a little over 4%.
Right. And so this place that's supposed to be this dynamo, the most advanced country, the center of the world system that everybody should emulate, is failing profoundly right before our eyes.
Just to put it in numbers, the global death rate is 120 persons per million. The United States right now is precisely five times that, 606 deaths per million population. So we're five times overrepresented in deaths. And in the Asia-Pacific countries that I mentioned, the deaths are basically near zero per million population. If I look at some of the real success stories in Korea, rather than 500 or 600 deaths per million, it's 7 deaths per million. In Singapore, 5 per million. In New Zealand, 5 per million. And so one can see the consequences of this very stark. And I think the point about the health system is really important to underscore. Public health, our life expectancy, our well-being, certainly depends on three different things. One is the healthcare system of the hospitals and the clinics. And there the U.S. Has lots of high tech and so forth, as you noted, but an incredibly expensive system that is, in per-person terms, typically about twice what our peer countries are spending. As a proportion of income, we're at about 18% of national income. They're at 10 to 12% of national income. It's a shocking difference because it's big bucks and big monopoly power. But then the second pillar of health is not the hospitals, but the public health, the preventative system. For example, the testing and tracing system of an epidemic. And there we failed completely we see that our Centers for Disease Control, which is supposed to be our public health arm, not our hospital arm, but our public health arm, was so degraded that it could not lead proper testing in this country. And it's so politicized by Trump and his cronies that it is basically warned against speaking the truth on this. Now, there's a third determinant of health, which is called the social determinants of health, which have to do not so much with the clinics and the healthcare, even with the formal public health teams, but with the inequalities in society and whether people have healthy diets, healthy lifestyles, whether there is huge a huge underclass that is by social reasons facing much higher rates of stress and so forth. Well, it turns out that the United States has all of those characteristics because we're the least equal, the most unequal of any of the high-income democracies in the so-called Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD Club of High-Income Democratic Countries. And what you can see, Rob, looking around the world, quite striking statistically, is that the unequal countries are doing much worse. Poor people are more vulnerable. Poor people lack access. Poor people have prior health conditions, such as chronic pulmonary conditions or chronic cardiovascular conditions. And so the United States is also paying a huge price for being such an unequal society. And we see that in all aspects of the pandemic, who has jobs, who doesn't, who has become unemployed versus who can work online, who has the safety of being able to live in the digital world and essentially protected versus the frontline workers typically working at very low pay, but having to work day by day to keep food on the table. And the United States is paying a really fearsome price for this social inequality, which has caused us to be routed by this pandemic.
I think it's good that you underscore these results. The how would I say? The unmasking requires diagnosis so that we can construct proper remedies in the medium term. I want to shift focus for a little bit now. You have a new book, The Ages of Globalization, Ages Plural. And I see from looking through it that there are seven ages that you cite. And you're looking back for lessons regarding the present and the future. What inspired you to write this book? And what is the essence of what you're trying to say?
Well, that's a great question about what led me to write it, because it is partly my own intellectual journey over the past 35 years of thinking about these issues. And this new book results from a series of lectures that I gave at the School of Geography in Oxford University in 2017. You know, when I began work as an economic advisor, it was in Bolivia, South America, 1985, in the Bolivian hyperinflation. And I had some tools of monetary economics, which fortunately were helpful and helped Bolivia to end the hyperinflation. But for me, it was a mind-boggling experience working in the high Andes region, 12,000 feet above sea level, in a society shaped by its physical geography. And I was forced to start confronting issues about the relations of society and economics in ways that I had never been led to in any of my classes and any of my studies, training, or early career on the faculty of Harvard University, even though I was professor of international trade, and it's a pretty basic issue, the role of physical geography in that. But I had no training in this, but it opened my eyes. You know, Bolivia was so distinctive in terms of being landlocked, in terms of being in the high mountain region, in terms of the kinds of commodities that it could sell, in terms of the ways that it was connected to the world economy. And two things struck me at that time. One was this eye-opening reality about the shaping forces of the physical earth. And that led me through the last 35 years in many different directions, including looking at zoonotic diseases, to questions of climate change, to questions of how geography shapes economics. The second point that was very striking for me in 1985 was how everything that Bolivia did in terms of its policy choices seemed to me to relate to the question, how does this country, a small country in the Andean region, relate to the rest of the world? In other words, international trade and finance was absolutely essential to thinking through any kind of national strategy and economic direction. And when I worked in Bolivia, then other parts of Latin America, then in Eastern Europe, starting in 1989 with the transition from the Soviet era to the post-Soviet era, the question there also was all about the interconnections of, say, Poland with Europe. And for several years, I realized in practice, oh my God, I'm watching a global economy take shape that's interconnected. I was watching the end of the Iron Curtain and the division between the U.S.-led part of the world at the time and the Soviet-led part of the world come together and become integrated economically. Now, somewhat naively, I thought, okay, I'm watching globalization being born. Then, with a little bit more historical insight, I said, no, no, that's not really true. Globalization was the phenomenon of the 19th century and the Pax Britannica during the British imperial days knitted together the world economy. And then I thought, as I thought more about this and learned more about it, no, really, we're at the third globalization, because probably the first globalization was the voyages of discovery, so-called, of Columbus and Vasco da Gama, and that's what knit the world together. Well, I think you probably can see the trend. The more I've thought about this, studied this, analyzed this, I reached the conclusion that the only right way to think about this is that Homo sapiens sapiens, our species, or sometimes just referred to as anatomically modern humans, which dispersed from Africa sometime between 70,000 and 50,000 years ago to spread around the world, has been globalizing from that first dispersion. And so I think we are a global species intrinsically, and not just that we're living in all parts of the world, but we are trading, we are moving, we are migrating, we are exchanging ideas, we are transmitting pathogens, we're transmitting animal and plant species, we're sending minerals and processed goods, whether it's cloth or glassware, or polished gems, as in the trade in prehistoric days. But we have been at this globalization business for the time of our species life, at least since the dispersal from Africa. So I have ended up with a seven stage or seven ages categorization, starting with the first dispersions and reaching the whole world in settlement, and then second, the birth of agriculture, the Neolithic age. A third, I consider to be the domestication of the horse about 3000 BC, which was fundamental. It was like inventing the automobile at the time. It changed the structure and the dynamics of society. It gave way, starting around 1000 BC, to the ages of great empires, the Neo-Assyrian, Neo-Babylonian, the Achaemenid Persian empires, Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire, and so forth. The next phase was indeed the ocean globalization of the period of Columbus and Vasco da Gama, which incidentally, Adam Smith declared that those two voyages were the most important events in the history of mankind, said Smith, because they brought together the whole world into one interconnection. And then the sixth phase, in my view, is born with the steam engine, which created the possibility of an industrial age. And then the seventh, my claim is now, that we have entered a new age of globalization, really paced in our case by the digital age. So I see technology as a quite fundamental driver. The book's theme is that it's technology interacting with physical geography, interacting with human institutions, meaning culture and politics, that drive these processes. But as the basic pacer of global change, I regard technology as the most fundamental of the arrows of change, and believe that the digital age, which one could say is probably about 90 years old now, but really reaching a fundamentally new era, but dating back to the discoveries of and the inventions of Alan Turing and John von Neumann, that this is the shaper of our age. And it happens that COVID-19 has accelerated this digitalization of our economies, probably during the last 8 months, by at least a decade, if not two decades, of what was the pace beforehand. I mean, we've just gone online suddenly, and I don't think we're ever going back to the kind of economy that we had before.
It's what my friends who are Star Wars aficionados call warp speed.
There you go. And it's just incredible how many times, and I heard it again today, but I've heard it nonstop since March, companies employing thousands of people that within a week went completely online and learned, oh my God, we can do this. And of course, the universities did that almost overnight. And it's been a mark of those places like the Asia-Pacific countries tend to be more online to begin with and with more universal access. That's proven to be an incredible dynamic that's underway right now. And it's everybody's discussion. Especially here in New York, we have Manhattan is built for offices. Will people go back? What's all that real estate going to be used for? I think it's going to be used for very different things in the future, is my own view.
Yeah, very, very interesting questions. Jeff, I think you're seeing all of these changes in this velocity with very clear eyes. But you and I both work in the realm of education. And I have a third grader and a sixth grader who are now working from home. My third grader is more skillful with an iPad now than I've ever been. And I'm watching those changes. But at some level, I'm grateful for the technology at the moment because of what you described in the first part of this, which is without social distancing, without quarantine, the propagation of the pandemic explodes. And I see a lot of tension, particularly at small colleges, which depend upon the rental of their dorms for income. I see a lot of professors frightened to rejoin classes. I see a lot of pressure from working parents to get their children back to school, particularly if they're two working parents and they can't really afford daycare. There's all kinds of stresses inside the system, but the technology is allowing the children to continue to be educated without adding to the risk. And with the colleges and in places like Israel and others, the primary schools, as they open, children get infected, parents, grandparents, and teachers die more frequently.
It's a huge question and debate, and the way we put it in, and I considered it to be probably among the most, or maybe the most vexing questions that we faced in stating what to do about this. I think the following is certainly the point, one simple point. If there is large-scale transmission of the virus in the society at large, you cannot open the schools, period. The schools are spreader institutions. Children get very sick, or they get infected at least. It's not safe, and it becomes a part of the dynamic of ongoing transmission. If the amount of transmission is very low in the community, as in the Asia Pacific, in most of those countries, it's probably possible to open the schools. When you're in between, my view is to lean towards online and to, of course, redouble the effort to stop the pandemic, but also to redouble the effort to make sure that every child can get online and can have universal access. One of the hardships of the online education was a lot of kids, especially poor kids, don't have access. But I've spoken to the heads of the telecoms companies and so on in many parts of the world. We could move very fast to ensure universal online access to some level of broadband, and also design even emergency pricing and access and subscriptions for the sake of young children. So I'm of the view that online has a lot of merit. A lot of educators say, no, 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 you've got to get into the classroom, but not when it's unsafe, first of all. And I don't want us to lose sight of all the benefits, by the way, of online also, because there are some intrinsic things you can do with online learning, not necessarily for young children, but say at university level, that is otherwise impossible. I like to put classrooms together online around the world so that students from different countries are actually interacting with each other, or so that you can bring a lecturer from any place in the world to lecture to thousands of students simultaneously or hundreds of students across the world, something that otherwise is logistically impossible. So I'm a technophile to begin with, but I believe we have tremendous possibilities for fruitful use of these technologies, not only as last resort in a pandemic, but actually as first resort tools for just interesting new methods of pedagogy, and hope that we take it in that spirit. But in the meantime, we also face the reality of the digital divide. And in my work at the UN, I'm really calling for a clear goal. I want a sustainable development goal number 18, which is universal access to digital services, and focus the attention of the tech industry, which, my God, it has money and access and scalability, to ensure that everybody has access to these technologies.
I think that I've been doing some work with the INET Commission on Global Economic Transformation, and where this seems particularly acute in a 40-year horizon is in Africa, where the demography suggests that the working age population will double in the next 50 years, and where they are in equatorial regions, so the what you might call reliability of subsistence farming in the context of global warming is going to be very problematic. And then finally, in the era of global supply chains and automation, the East Asian development model, infant industry protection, manufacturing, and export, doesn't look particularly viable. But potentially a what you might call public good technology infrastructure linking together many different regions and sectors may constitute a new form of uplift and development. And having this demographic bulge, or these young people, have access to learning and practice will have a great deal to do with the success we see in the years ahead.
I agree with all of that. I would add a couple of points. One is that even the demography itself will be very importantly shaped by whether kids are in school. Probably the number one factor in fertility rates and fertility choice is schooling. And I think it will be important for Africa on many different levels to have a voluntary reduction of fertility rates, which now still are around four per woman as total fertility rate on average, and much higher in rural areas. The way to achieve that, with all the benefits for everybody, for the moms, the families, the children, the society, the economic development, is through education. And education can be online to an important extent right now, and we can reach a lot more kids effectively through online education. So that is one point that I would emphasize. A second point is that I think these digital technologies really are tremendous leapfrog technologies for many, many purposes. Education being one, telemedicine being another very important one. Most of rural Africa does not have radiologists around, but it doesn't matter anymore. You can read images anywhere in the world if you're online, if you have telemedicine consults. And that's just one of countless examples about how to extend medical and healthcare services. Of course, payments has already leapfrogged online. Many parts of low-income countries and low-income Africa had no banks at all. But then came M-Pesa or electronic wallet technologies, and suddenly people were able to transact, pay, and save online. Governance can be improved tremendously with a unique identification, and governments can make humanitarian payments or transfer payments or collect taxes through online. We can basically end informality, which is a real burden to development, because with informality, you neither collect taxes nor are able to provide social services adequately, but an online identity enables almost an instantaneous overcoming of informality. So I see so many areas where there can be huge advances in provision of core services, or even in assisting in precision agriculture, and so on. The downside is, like you say, labor-intensive manufacturing development pathways are basically closed off. So the earning of foreign exchange is going to have to come in other ways. It can still come in agriculture or mining, but that's not where the jobs are going to be. And I think it's going to be very important to think about open source technologies and so forth to even make the leapfrogging all that much more effective by enabling the poor countries to get access to intellectual goods, as it were, and the digital services without the monopoly rents of patent-protected products. So there's a lot to think about, but net-net, I believe that digital technology is a strong friend of African development.
I tend to agree. I agree. Jeff, I would say one of my highlights of my year 2019 was a lunch at the Pontifical Academy of Social Science at the Vatican, where you made a presentation about what I will call the history of social thought, philosophical, religious, and economic. And just as your Ages of Globalization book looks through the phases and tries to discern from a history of events what might be on our horizon, your search on that day in the realm of ideas and where congestion, contradiction, failure come from was very, very profound. I was sitting across from Joe Stiglitz. He was very moved. Describe for me that project, because you and I have talked a little bit about where you're going with the backward look for forward guidance in the realm of ideas.
Yeah, thank you. This is, and I think you would agree with me, and we can tell everyone, there's a certain magic at the Vatican and at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, that the house of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences is called the Casina Pio Quattro. It is the home of Pope Pius IV from the 16th century, when the Pope came from the lower marshes of Rome up to the hills of the Vatican region to escape from malaria each summer season. And it's a wondrous, inspiring setting. And for me, the church is also an absolute sheer joy of how it is a carrier of great ancient wisdom, not only its own early thinkers, the so-called doctors of the church, but also the Greek philosophers. Probably the dominant philosophical view of the Roman Catholic Church is called Thomist thinking, from St. Thomas Aquinas, the medieval great theologian and philosopher who looked back to Aristotle, my favorite philosopher, for wisdom of organizing thought and ethical thought. So I have tried to overcome a problem in our education as economists that I didn't even know about or realize for most of my professional life in any organized way. And that is, when you enter economics, or at least when I did in the 1970s, I was told that I will learn what's called neoclassical economics. Neoclassical economics is the synthesis of economic thinking in the 20th century to mathematize what was called classical economics. Classical economics, as it came to be called, is what Adam Smith launched in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, and then followed by Malthus, Bentham, Ricardo, Mill, Marx, and others of different persuasions. But the idea was the classic age of economics was the Adam Smith age, and the neoclassical age was the mathematization of those ideas. Well, it's a very funny idea, I have to say, that the classics are for economics starting in 1776. From any other field, and certainly for historians, you wouldn't say the classic age is the late 18th century. You would say the classic age is probably 500 BC, maybe to the end of the Western Roman Empire, perhaps. So 500 BC to 500 AD, roughly speaking. But economists get it in this absolutely weird way because we're not trained at all in historical thinking, and we're not trained, at least I wasn't trained in historical thinking, and I wasn't trained with any perspective of the history of Western thought. Well, it has for many, many years struck me that I needed to understand these foundational ideas more. And starting around 10 years ago, I became at least literate in the foundations of ethical philosophy with the Socratic school and so forth. But in recent years, it's become a great love of mine, in fact, to understand this sweeping thought from even the pre-Socratic thinkers up through Adam Smith. How did we get to where we are right now? And the more you learn about that, Rob, the more you learn how weird economics is, because what we're told about what human beings are and what is ethics and so forth is so far out of a tradition of two millennia that it is a completely striking phenomenon of how one can live within an intellectual milieu where the language and the ideas, the thoughts, the presuppositions, the axioms are so far afield from what others who have thought about this deeply have concluded. Well, just to round this off, as I began to know and understand and really fall in love with the Aristotelian ethics and Aristotelian political thinking and the Greek idea of well-being, or eudaimonia, as the Greeks called it, I have come to the view that modern neuroscience and psychology and some aspects of the social sciences give us reason to believe that what the ancients, the truly classical age, held about human nature and insight have tremendous resonance with the cutting edge ideas about evolutionary psychology, neuroscience, social psychology, and so forth, and that economics took a kind of detour of Enlightenment view of human nature, which had some merit, but had a lot of strangeness to it as well. And that if we're going to get economics back on track, we need to get the ethical foundations of economic thinking back on track. And that really means to engage with the whole sweep of ethical thought from the classic age up through the modern human sciences, including psychology and neuroscience. So that's the bent that I'm on right now. And I have to tell you, I find it exhilarating, but it's a lot. And I'm trying to write a book right now to put these thoughts together. And at least the exercise of it is wonderfully exciting for me.
I also think it's very important in the context of the next phase of globalization. Because as Zbigniew Brzezinski said in 2010 before the Council on Foreign Relations in Montreal, the whole world was awakened by the great financial crisis, that something was up, something was wrong. Faith, trust in expertise and governance was shaken. But very importantly, in relation to the exploration you're doing, he also said, we've gone from a G7 or G5 world of North Atlantic Enlightenment thinking, largely run by Caucasians and the Judeo-Christian tradition, to a G20 where the philosophical traditions are like big tectonic plates and they are in some tension with each other. And what Brzezinski saw in that speech as quite disconcerting is that when people are unsettled and they've lost trust and faith, they want to see a new vision of order and a consensus that things converge to. And he wondered if that was possible, because what you might call the hardened economistic view of Enlightenment models of human behavior were in quite marked contrast, particularly with Chinese and Indian philosophy.
Zbigniew Brzezinski was a very smart man. By the way, when I worked in Poland from 1989 into the early 1990s, he was a huge help and just a wonderful gentleman also. And I think his statement is very important. And a part of my question, which is, can we find a common ethics that is something that resonates globally and not only circumstantially to Western Europe and the United States, for example? And I take heart in that, because I do believe that ethics is about our fundamental human nature and how we can achieve well-being. And I do believe that our fundamental human nature is a global human nature, that we are one species and that our evolutionary history teaches us about that. And we can take some comfort, I believe, in two points. One is that the foundational period for our civilizations, whether it's Chinese or Indian or Persian, Judeo-Christian and then Islamic, were all part of the same period that Jaspers called the Axial Age, roughly the period from about 800 BC to about 200 BC. And though these civilizational patterns emerged independently, they in fact had tremendous coincident ideas. But I think if we look a little bit more deeply, there were actually exchanges of ideas even back then. And I've been trying to understand myself how Persian and Hellenistic ideas interacted and helped to shape Judaism and Christianity in philosophical outlooks as well. So bottom line for me is that I do believe we need a global ethic. I think we can find a global ethic. I'm heartened by the fact that when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was promulgated under the lead of Eleanor Roosevelt in 1948, the committee that formed that really had representatives of lots of civilizations, and a lot of Confucianism was built in, for example, into the Universal Declaration. And I think we need to explore that common ground and actually champion that common ground in a self-reflective way, not just in an automatic way, but in a way that we all recognize together that we're searching for that common ground. Because as Brzezinski said, we need to feel comfortable in our skins that we can manage together these challenges. I think it's possible.
Well, Jeff, I guess as we're coming down to the finish, I want to emphasize to the more than 10,000 young scholars in our Young Scholars Initiative a bit of the model of your career. When I first learned of you through the Rommel family, you were just about to publish something. Essentially, it was in the Brookings Panel on Economic Activity, and it was what I would call about what supply-side rigidities in particularly Europe and traditional macroeconomics. And as time evolved, I saw you moving toward climate change, moving towards the transformations related to the end of the Soviet Union, moving towards Africa, and particularly moving always like with this unrelenting desire to understand. And I always thought of you, and I often think in terms of music, and obviously we're both from Detroit, that Diana Ross's song, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, was kind of the, you were a mountain climber in economics. And so I look at this time, and you talked about trading, moving, migrating, evolving. And that's what I see you having done. I remember being at that Pontifical Academy. I had spoken before the lunch, and you gave this beautiful luncheon address. And at the end of the Pope's presentation after lunch, Pope Francis, I teased him a little bit because the movie The Two Popes had had a passage about the Beatles and Abbey Road. And I took him the box set of the Beatles Abbey Road with all of the outtakes and gave it to him, and he got the joke, and we laughed together. And I, the person who curates the Beatles, Jeff Jones, he's a very dear friend of mine. He had been at my birthday party. He got me that set, and he and I wrote a letter to the Pope about how he reminded us with his vitality, creativity, and positiveness of the Beatles, how the Beatles had a certain love and not hatred and inspiration that was very, very powerful. And so I look at today and I think of Martha Reeves and the Vandellas back in Detroit, nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. I think of Diana Ross, theme from Mahogany. Do you know where you're going to? Do you like the things that life is showing you? And obviously there are many things that we don't. But there's a song by a Detroit band from the 1970s called The Romantics. And when I listen to you take us through the seven ages of globalization, when I've studied the evolution of your career and it's inspired me, and when I'm hearing about neuroscience and social psychology, people like Jonathan Haidt and others are getting closer to economics, when I'm seeing you reaching to the ethics, the song that came to mind is called What I Like About You. And that's by the Romantics, another Detroit band. And I want to say, Jeff, you are a great model of unrelenting curiosity and exploration. And every one of our young scholars should take heed of your example and emulate the kind of striving that you've achieved in your life.
Rob. Thank you. That's unbelievably generous. It confirms how many good things come out of Motown from all of the good labels you mentioned. And thank God for Berry Gordy giving us that inspiration. I actually want to, if I might, just say, boy, do I agree with you about Pope Francis and the joy that he brings. And he's recently made wonderful statements about exactly that kind of need for joy, that ethics doesn't mean grimness, religion doesn't mean grimness, it does mean joy and well-being also. And he referred to a movie, in fact, his favorite movie, apparently, Babette's Feast, a Danish movie about a great feast, and we just watched it, my wife and I, and it is indeed incredibly joyful and eye-opening, that's Pope Francis, so we all need that inspiration too. But it's so good to be with you, and I'm so grateful for those nice words.
Well, they're heartfelt and well-deserved, and I do think when you and I talk many times about our formative years in Detroit, we didn't grow up in an easy, what I call equilibrium. We grew up in a cauldron, labor management conflict, the Vietnam War, anti-war movement. The Port Huron Statement wasn't that far away from us. or Tom Hayden at University of Michigan. We had the race riots, obviously, in 67 and Dr. King's death in 68. We had the demise, the deterioration of Detroit, where the way I looked at it, Jeff, was that the violence and velocity of the deterioration of Detroit was almost like it was divorced from the nation called the United States. And that downturn, and you and I both had parents and parents who had friends that were in great despair, what we now call the diseases of despair, suicide, alcoholism, and the like. But most of the, what I will call cover for what was happening, because it would frighten anyone's faith in the American dream, was a cover that essentially said corrupt black public administration, pointing at Coleman Young, and the entrepreneurs lost their mojo. And I think part of what fuels me in being at the helm of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and part of that vitality that I described about you, I think comes from our seed experience in Detroit, where you just can't go along with the consensus very easily.
Well, that era, which you described, which was formative for both of us, was definitely an era of striving also, and a very, very complicated era. But I think it stays with you, the 60s, for those who were, born and grew up in that cauldron. So there's probably a lot of that in both of us, inevitably. But one of the ideas of that was we can do better. I think that is a driving, motivating idea.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was Graham Nash, we can change the world. We're starting to do better.
Right.
Yeah, that's
hey,
right.
Why not?
Well, Jeff, thanks for being with me today. We will have a presidential election coming up. And I think right after that, I'm going to knock on your door again, because I think it would be very, very helpful to have another episode where we, what you might call, experience your guidance as to what the next administration needs to do to help the world get back on track.
We got a date.
Thanks.
That sounds great.
Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Wonderful.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing.